The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I am Chris Buskirk. He is Seth Leibson. Welcome back to the Seth and Chris Show. Seth, you make a good point. We're talking about a restaurant that I see. I've never eaten there. I see it all the time when I'm in Washington. It's in the Reagan Airport. It's a place called Legal Seafood. I shake my head every time I see it. That's what they want to be known for. Food. Hey, come eat here. Our food is not illegal.
Yeah.
Totally legal.
Well, they wouldn't say that. As Paul on Twitter corrected me, they would say our food is not undocumented.
Right, not undocumented seafood.
Right.
Doing the jobs other seafood won't do.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. We don't want any undocumented seafood. But that was the restaurant that we were thinking about. Black market seafood.
That would be good.
I still think that has more panache. That has more marketing appeal.
Yeah.
That's the Commando 450. I don't sell that one. What about this?
No, that's what we want. It's a Commando 450.
That's the black market shower heads. No, that's the one we want, the Commando 450. Because we use it for elephants and circuses. And Kramer goes, yes, that's the one.
Yeah, that's the one.
Oh, dear.
Seth, today is the day that the president made official what he's been talking about. Well, I was going to say what he's been talking about for a week, but really what he's been talking about for 20 years. Which is the imposition of tariffs on some certain countries which have been, in his view, and I think he's right, generally right on this, have been unfairly dumping product in the United States to the detriment of U.S. employers, U.S. manufacturers. There's a piece written at American Greatness called Why Trump is Right About Tariffs. Before I get to that, though, is I was just noted. You know, during the hour break we were looking at the television, Fox and CNN on different televisions, and keep seeing the Chiron talking about the imminent trade war. Is that hyperbole? Really? I mean, you have a tariff, and that tariff equals war. That doesn't make any sense, Seth. We have tariffs right now. On all kinds of goods and products, goods and services. Right now, are we at war with every country with whom we have a tariff? Question. I mean, the sort of know-nothingism that we see, or sensationalism, or combination of the two that we see in the media right now is just. I mean, we talk about it all the time, and yet I'm still stunned. Seth, you know this. Tariffs were the main source of revenue for this country from 1789 until 1914.
Yeah, I think it was the second bill the first Congress passed, if I'm not mistaken.
And
it
was
recommended by Alexander Hamilton, who's supposed to be some kind of financial genius and created our treasury.
Not a source of revenue, the main source of revenue for the federal government for the first 125 years of this country's existence from 1789 until 1914, the main source of revenue was tariffs. So my question is this. For everybody talking about the trade wars, was the United States at war with every other country on the planet between 1789 and 1914? Of course not. Of course not. It's ridiculous to say that. It is absolutely ridiculous to say that. Here's just I'll just quote this. I mean, this is Wikipedia, okay, just to give people a quick idea. It says, during this period, there was a vigorous debate between the various political parties over the setting of tariff rates. In general, Democrats favored a tariff that would pay the cost of government, but no higher, and Whigs and Republicans favored higher tariffs to protect and encourage American industry and industrial workers.
So the debate was how big, not whether.
Not whether. So, there were two different goals. They both agreed on one of the goals. The one goal was we're going to use tariffs in order to fund the federal government. This is our revenue source as a country. Whigs and Democrats, the two main, and then ultimately Republicans in the 1850s and 60s, agreed on that much. The only question was, do we make them higher or not in order to have an additional impact, which is, this was the Whig/Republican point of view, which was to protect and encourage American industry and protect and encourage and to protect American industry and the workers who worked in those industries. That was the debate. That was the debate. This was something that was totally accepted in the United States at that time, even after 1914, tariffs continued to be a large component of federal revenue for a number of years after that. Why 1914? Well, because in 1913, we passed an amendment which legalized the income tax, and that's when the addiction to bigger, to more revenue and more spending started with the federal government. They had a source where they could get more revenue. Right, which is to tax every single person in the country based on their income. And that's when we started to see the size of the Leviathan state grow out of control. Why? Because they basically went from only being able to sustain a modest sized federal government because of tariffs, because they were being funded by tariffs, in order to get to a point where they were able to spend more and more money. And then with the growth of the state during World War I, and then, of course, the massive growth of the state during the New Deal and the Depression, and then through World War II, and then we went from the mid-40s, 1945, the end of World War II, to the 60s and the Great Society programs, the federal government grew and grew and grew. It even outstripped its ability to balance the budget on the income tax, and then started the borrowing binge. The idea, though, that tariffs are something new in American history is just false. Is just false. How often do I have to say it? History is the undiscovered country. You find out a lot of things if you just know your history. And so, for the United States to impose tariffs is not unusual. In fact, it has been the norm. You know, Seth, our mutual friend Charles Kessler, he wrote about this, gosh, almost 2 years ago now in the Claremont Review of Books. He wrote an essay talking about Trump and Trumpism. He said President Trump actually harkens back to an older form of the Republican Party.
Right.
And he wasn't talking about the 60s. He was talking about, sort of a central, a pre-World War II, in some cases really even a pre-World War I type of Republican Party that's very much focused on the government doing its basic things right, protecting the rights and the economic advantages and prerogatives of the American citizens.
Yeah. I mean, you have to remember the experience of Donald Trump in business is and was as someone who just didn't put up with nonsense, things that didn't make sense, systems that didn't work, bureaucracy, challenged the bureaucracy a lot. Remember the calling card of his with the ice skating rink and his fight with Ed Koch over that. What's it called? The Welton rink?
Welton.
Something like that. And
Woolman.
That's it.
Thank you.
Well done, Bill. Woolman rink. And how he built it under budget and under time after it had languished for years. This is a man of little patience for bureaucratic things that just don't make sense.
You know, I'm just looking at some statistics here. The average the norm from 1789 to 1914 was that basically any good that came into the United States had a tariff imposed on it. It averaged about 20%. Some of them were as high as 95%, and they would go up and down depending on the needs of the government and some of the particulars. Right now, the tariff that Donald Trump imposed, it's on two goods, aluminum and steel, on two goods, and he has exempted imports from Mexico and China. Not that we import a lot of aluminum Mexico and Canada, because he's working on a bigger project there, which is renegotiating NAFTA. So he said, okay, fine, we'll exempt Mexico and China. There are two biggest trading partners. They are also our two neighbors and subject to a separate agreement that we are in the process of negotiating. So I think it's a common sense carve out to say, all right, we're working on a different project with Canada and with Mexico. We're not going to impose these tariffs on them. But everybody else, yeah, we're going to 25%. There was a study that that was quoted in the Washington Post last week. Now, what good can you think of, consumer good, can you think of that consumes the most steel and aluminum? The car, right? The automobile. I mean, that's the thing that the average person will buy that will be most affected by this. What this study did, again, quoted in the Washington Post last week, is that these tariffs will increase the price of a car $30. $30.
I've seen it as high as 40. But the point being.
Yeah.
The point being.
Average car, I don't know. What's the average car? $35,000? I mean, it's nothing. But,
right.
Is the point.
Right. And you can't do it, Chris. You can't do it in isolation. You also are doing this at the same time. You are seeing people's paychecks increase, well, in Arizona, somewhere around the neighborhood of $2,500.
Right.
So when you give them $2,500 but are saying, yeah, your cars might go up about $30 to $40, it's a pretty good trade.
Pretty good trade. More than that, Seth, is that this is something that is intended to stimulate job and wage growth here at home. That's really the key here, right? We're not doing this just out of pique. Donald Trump's doing this because he wants us to rebuild our industrial base here, which is important for our national security, both in terms of our ability to fight and wage war, to protect our borders, but also in terms of our economic prosperity, and to be able to maintain our economic dominance. I'm Chris Buskirk. He's Seth Leibson. We'll be right back. This is a song about Donald Trump going to Washington.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, it is.
I'm Chris Buskirk. He's Seth Leibson. Welcome back. Talking about tariffs. It sounds like, from looking at our board, looks like people want to talk about this. Give us a ring, 602-508-0960. That's the number, 602-5080-960. Talking about the tariffs that Donald Trump imposed on aluminum and steel imports. He carved out Canada and Mexico, but from other countries there is now... going forward will be a 25% tariff. Goal here is what? Punish these countries? No, not really. I mean, the goal here is simply to build up an industrial base in this country that starts with aluminum and steel in the president's judgment, and to build up to protect American jobs, build up those jobs. People say, well, we don't do that in this country. That's just not American. It's not good for the country. Well, that was the norm in this country from 1789 until 1914. That was the number one source of revenue for the federal government were tariffs. And by the way, it didn't just cut off in 1914. It's just that in 1914, the income tax came into play and became a bigger source of revenue. Tariffs continued to be a major source of revenue for the federal government for years after that as well. The point is that both political parties agreed. There was a broad, deep consensus that tariffs were good for the country. They were an appropriate way to raise revenue for the federal government. That was a big part of it. That was a big part of why they did it. It's just simple. Well, we need money. How are we going to get it? We're going to get it from tariffs. That was one part. The other part was, and this was the Republican position, by the way, for many, many years, the Republican position was that we would use tariffs in order to protect American industry so that the American industry could get stronger, so that we could be an exporter, not an importer. So we would do this in order to protect American industry and to protect American jobs and raise American wages. That was the Republican position. Now, disagree with it if you like. Make the argument if you want. But the argument that this is something completely unheard of in American history, well, that's just false. The idea that you're going to see on the news, because I've seen it all day long, trade war, trade war, trade war. Now we're at war with everybody. Well, were we at war with all these countries for every country on the planet between 1789 and 1914? No. It's just false. Are we at war with with every country with whom we have a tariff on a good or a service that they send to us now? Because these are not the only tariffs in place right now. Are we at war with those countries? No, of course not. Let's go to the phones. Gilbert in Phoenix, welcome to the Seth and Chris Show.
Hey, guys, thanks for having me on. Hey, listen, I'm just an average American who voted for Trump, and let me just tell you how what I view when I hear Donald Trump talk about this. I don't view him as a man who believes in tariffs or doesn't believe in it. I believe that he believes in the bigger picture. He believes in fairness and reciprocal trade, and he's talked about it before. Tariffs is just a byproduct of unfairness. And so I think Donald Trump is being misrepresented, like in the media a lot and others, he really does care about two countries shaking hands and saying, let's do what's right for you and what's right for us. And let me just finish, and I'll get off, let other people get on. This is just my opinion. The average American citizen, the average, you know, American-loving citizen and an investor from the outside world, outside of America, they do not mind paying taxes. The problem we have is that it's not fair and it's being squandered. And I think that's why we like Donald Trump, because he speaks that plain English. He wants our taxes to be fair and to be put to good use. And that's why we're upset. And so on the tax issue, on the tariff issue, I think there's a bigger picture. It's Donald Trump is always preaching fair and reciprocal. And that's just my two cents. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, Gilbert. I appreciate it. Yeah, right. I think, look, Gilbert has been listening to what the president has been saying as opposed to listening to what people have been saying about the president. Two very different things. Donald Trump has been very consistent on this point. And I think Gilbert's right when he says that Donald Trump is not at some basic fundamental level for or against tariffs. He's a pragmatist. He looks at these as a means to an end. The end is to try and protect American jobs, increase American wages, and most important, to rebuild the American industrial economy so that we have some of these core industries here at home. What we have found over the past, I don't know, 40 years-ish, what we have found is that the argument that says, yeah, we can export, meaning we can ship overseas the low-value manufacturing jobs and the high-value, high-skill jobs will stay here at home, that's the argument we've been hearing for two generations almost. That's not true. It just isn't true. What happens is that the first thing to go is the low-value manufacturing. The first thing to go is the easy part of the manufacturing process where maybe it's very labor-intensive, maybe it's not very skilled, and so you go to a low-wage jurisdiction and you manufacture, you assemble there, and then you import the products back in, but you keep everything else at home. You keep the skilled manufacturing at home, and then you also keep the R&D at home, you keep the corporate offices at home, the marketing, all those sorts of things. That's always been the argument. Yeah, fine, what do we care? We'll get rid of the low skill stuff. We'll send those things overseas, and guess what? It's actually going to be the best of all possible worlds, because at home, what are we going to have? We're just going to have the high skill, high wage jobs left over. That has been shown over and over again just not to be true. The first thing to go is the low-skilled jobs, but then over time, what happens is that then the high-skilled jobs go, then the R&D goes, then the other corporate functions go as well. We have seen that time and time again. Why does that happen? Because these other functions need to be where the manufacturing is. They just do. That's what happens. Now we've seen this in things like injection molding. We've seen this in other types of manufacturing where the low skill stuff, the high labor cost stuff goes away, and then the R&D goes, and pretty soon, over time, just the center of gravity of the operation, the center of gravity of the business goes elsewhere. And what about all the things that happen around those businesses, the spin-offs, the intellectual capital, the skilled labor, that type of human capital? That's all located someplace else. And so now the other businesses that get started up based on the human capital and the intellectual capital, well, that happens someplace else too. Think about a city like Detroit, right? Think about a city like Detroit. In Detroit, of course, we have the big three there. You have Ford, General Motors, Chrysler. Manufacturing was done in Detroit for years and years and years. People always think about Detroit as being the industrial center of this country, and in some ways it was, right? This is the place that this was the beating heart of the industrial war effort during World War II. But slowly those jobs moved. At first they moved out of Detroit. They moved to other parts of Michigan. Then they moved out of Michigan to other surrounding states. They moved downriver into places like Ohio and Indiana. And after that, they started to move overseas. Well, all those other businesses that thrived on being near the auto industry, on being near those automobile plants, those left too. There's a lot of other businesses that had to congregate near those businesses, or they existed simply because somebody walked out the door of Ford and said, you know what, I've got an idea of how I can start a business that does X, that does something else in the metal stamping business. Those sorts of businesses, those opportunities don't happen when you export your industrial base. That is, at a gut level, that's what Donald Trump is trying to reverse. He's trying to bring some of these core industries home, and so that then you have an ecosystem, you have a network that supports the production of other types of business opportunities and other types of industrial opportunities. That's something that that's not a trade war. That maybe is just smart economic policy that takes a longer-term view than what the next quarter's financial results are going to be for some public company. I'm Chris Buskirk. He's Seth Leibson. We'll be right back.
You gotta be tough as Texas and honest about your plans. If you're gonna run in Texas, you can't be a liberal man. Liberal Robert wanted to fit in, so he changed his name to Beto and hit it with a grin. Beto wants those open borders and he wants to take our guns. Not a chance on earth he'll get a vote from millions of Texans. If you're gonna run in Texas,
how good is this?
This is pretty great. This is
Ted Cruz.
This is Ted Cruz's ad.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it worked.
Tomorrow are we going to have Alabama Day?
Alabama the band or Alabama the state?
The band.
How about both?
Okay. No.
No,
no. Oh, no, I was being way too agreeable. No, just the band.
You don't like the state?
I love the state, but I just think that there's limited appeal and possibility.
Sweet Home Alabama?
Oh, you mean songs with the word Alabama in them.
Roll Tide? There's lots of Alabama things that people like that have seeped out into the wider culture.
Jimmy Buffett?
Jimmy Buffett, Alabama, Sweet Home Alabama. Maybe we've got them all by now. I don't know.
Yeah,
more.
Let's just stick with the band and see what happens.
Football.
Okay.
Yeah, the there was
this artist tomorrow, Alabama, done.
There was a story going around, Seth, being, as you would imagine, promoted by the mainstream media, which is that we might not be able to turn Texas blue just yet, but it's for sure going purple. And by the way, you guys may as well hang it up because we have the 2018 midterms all wrapped up because we are so much more enthusiastic. People hate Trump. People hate his agenda, yada, yada, yada. And you're going to see it in Texas. This is where you're really going to see it because the Democrats are going to turn out in a huge blue wave and just watch out. How'd that work out?
Oh, right.
It's a funny thing about elections. It's the only poll that matters, isn't it? Yeah. Right. We were told in the lead up to 2016, Donald Trump, not only is he going to lose, he's going to lose by 10, no, 20, no, no, he's going to lose by 150%.
The one thing I can say for certain is Donald Trump will not be the next president of the United States, right? This kind of talk all over the place.
All over the place. And, of course, on Election Day, we know what happened. Seth, there's a couple things that are going on here. Number one is in Texas, it just didn't happen. Yeah, the turnout was up a bit for Democrats.
Republicans.
But it was up more for Republicans. Republicans turned out more. There were more Republicans votes cast in the primary than in any other Texas primary ever. Okay?
So how's that by either party.
How's that for your...
I think.
By either party.
I
yeah,
think.
No, that's right. That I is think. True. So how's that for your enthusiasm gap in Texas? Yeah. Text, you know, Ted Cruz, whose ad.
We should go out with it, too.
Very funny ad. Yeah. We were just playing. Yeah, you know, he handily won, as he was expected to do. The point is though, that the Democrats that were supposedly so fired up, yeah, some of them showed up, but a lot of them just didn't. So why is this meme being pushed out into the mainstream media? Why is this the accepted wisdom? Well, some of it is people who are, we might just call useful idiots, who say, oh, well, I read it in the New York Times. It must be true, so I'm going to now go and repeat it. There's some of that. But look, some of this is also being done on purpose, right? Some of this is being done on purpose, which is it's psychological warfare. It's to say we can demoralize the enemy, Democrats and their allies and friends, well, maybe just their paid supporters at this point in the media, say, well, we can demoralize Republicans. We can demoralize their donors. And as a result, we can win. We can do it by that. We can just get them to give up. Don't give up, because it's not true. Robert Graham was in here the other day, Seth. I don't know if you heard this part of the show. He said something which I did not know, but doesn't surprise me when he said it. Do you remember back in 2000, in 2012. We had, it was kind of the dueling, the battles of the dueling sort of software packages that the two campaigns, the Obama campaign and the Romney campaign, who had the better modeling, who had the better turnouts, who was able to better micro-target their ads, all
those
sorts of things.
By the way, don't you hate those conversations?
I'm gonna say I don't. Okay, I'm going to nerd out and say that I actually find them interesting when the people who are talking actually know what they're talking about. That's the essential here. There are people who actually know these things well. That's a small group of people. There's a lot of people who talk about it like they actually know it. Remember that there was this program that the RNC and the Romney campaign had put together, which called ORCA. And this was supposed to be the turnout model to beat all turnout models. We're going to be able to micro-target down to a point where we know exactly what you had for breakfast this morning and how to get you to come out and vote for Romney. Well, it was basically the equivalent of an abacus, and it didn't work. But here's what Robert said, which I did not realize, is that there were all these stories that were being run throughout 2011 and 2012 by Democrats and by the Obama reelection team. They were saying, you know, we took our 2008 package, we dramatically upgraded it, and it's now the Terminator. We can do everything with this thing. And they ran all these stories in Politico and the Washington Post and the New York Times, every place else. Wasn't true at all. They didn't have it. The guy who ran that part of the Obama campaign is now on the record after the campaign on the record saying, in actuality, it was kind of a disaster for us, but we ran with the stories because we figured that if we could do that, that we would demoralize the Republicans. We could get Republican donors to sit on their hands, and it would become a self-fulfilling prophecy. We may not have the technological capabilities we claim, but we can still have better technology than the Republicans because we can make sure that it never gets funded and, as a result, never gets built. It's the exact same thing that's going on right now when Democrats and the mainstream media, as if there were any difference between those two things. They are all of one piece, all of basically one piece of whole cloth. They are doing the exact same thing now and saying that, look, Democrats, we've got the advantage. We've got an enthusiasm gap. People are fired up. We're going to get more Democrats out there, et cetera, et cetera. Trying to demoralize Republicans, trying to get Republican donors not to send money to the candidates, to the super PACs, et cetera, and that way to starve the Republican candidacies before they are ever able to get off the ground. Right, Seth?
Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons, though, Chris, that I said those kinds of discussions bore me terribly is partly what you said, that they almost don't bear any relationship to what actually happens on Election Day. They almost just don't. How many stories were we fed 4 years later about the ground game that Donald Trump did not have compared to the ground game that Hillary Clinton had? And, you know, I just still sometimes think politics matters. I just think politics matters.
I think that's right.
And
why politics matters.
You know, people go into these discussions and I think they sound great to the donor base. Honestly, I think they try and answer sell and bewitch donors with what great technology we're going to be deploying this time. I think the candidate matters. I think the message matters more. Those other discussions, they make me just want to have me sew my face to the carpet.
Look, as I said, they're interesting to me when the people who are talking about it are the very few people who know what they're talking about, because we need to get the messages, the real messages out to people who need to hear them, cut through all of the other things that people are trying to listen to or learn about or just entertain themselves with. Yeah, those things are important, right? This is why direct mail was such a big thing for Republicans in the 80s. But let's not forget the cynical part of this. Let's not forget the psychological warfare that goes on as well, and just say, look, if you support a candidate, give them money and vote for them, no matter what the New York Times says. I am Chris Busker. He is Seth Leibson. Welcome back to the Seth and Chris Show. Yeah, Seth, as I said, these discussions that really kind of get into the weeds, I find them to be interesting when the people who are leading the discussion actually know what they're talking about, mm-hmm. and not just, I don't care about the credential, I just care about people who really understand these things at a grassroots level because they've done them. There's just not many of those people out there, and a lot of the people that you see on on Fox or on CNN or whatever, the one-hit wonders in many cases. That's why, we've got a good news, bad news thing here. There's a piece, there's a clip I want to play here, Karl Rove from the other night after the the Texas primary. Why don't you roll that for me, please, Bill?
So you think these headlines about Texas, Carl, are misleading?
Oh, laughable. Look, the Republicans had the biggest turnout ever after the after all the hubbub coming in. This was the Democrats are having a fantastic night. They had a dreadful night. Their leader, Robert F. Beto O'Rourke, spent $4.2 million, won the Democratic primary with 62% of the vote. That's half as many votes as Ted Cruz got on the Republican side. 38% of the Democrats voted for Ed Kimbrough, a retired postal worker who spent $785, or 24% of the vote, which went to...
He's very popular, though, apparently.
Gets better. Seema Hernandez, a nurse, or maybe she's a former nurse. Her website suggests she used to be a nurse. She spent zero and got 24% of the vote. Now, she did have a Facebook page, but here's a guy who's supposed to be the darling of the Democrats, and four out of every 10 Democrats in the state, and he loses 103 out of 254 counties after spending $4.2 million and being the glory boy. And now he has a tendency in appearances to swear profusely on the campaign trail. I bet he was swearing a lot on Tuesday night.
Okay, so the good news, bad news here, Seth, is this, is that it looks like things went pretty darn well for Republicans down in Texas. Got a huge turnout. The bad news is we've got Karl Rove telling us that things went pretty well down in Texas for Republicans. And so when I say I like to hear from people who know what they're talking about, Karl Rove doesn't make the cut, right? He's still in the studio at Fox wondering why Mitt Romney didn't win Ohio in 2012 and isn't the president. One-hit wonder. Sorry. He just is. He just is. So I take a little bit of pause when I hear people who, I guess, have a history of being sort of A, wrong, but also being sort of Pollyannas. I want people who understand, who really get into this and understand this at a granular level. Not sure that Karl Rove does. He's at this point, he's a paid actor on television. Is that rude? I don't know. If so, I'm sorry, but that's the way I see it. So what I would say still is the same thing. Don't listen to the people on cable news. Politics does matter, as Seth says. Find the candidates who support your values. This is about conviction politics. And support them. Don't listen to what they say on television. Don't listen to them if they say, oh, the Democrats have it all sewn up. Support them. Do what you think is right. But, play the game all the way to the end. It's amazing what happens when you do that. We have a president in the White House now because a lot of Americans did just that.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.